Global consumerism is a $40 trillion a year phenomenon, which makes it the largest, most predictable investment opportunity on the planet. Who are the prime beneficiaries of global consumption trends? Mega brands. Welcome to the Mega Brands podcast series. I'm your host, Eric Clark. In this podcast, we explore mega trends through the lens of a global investor with the ultimate goal of identifying the most relevant, most innovative brands that are best positioned to become what I call mega brands. These are the brands that are customer obsessed, have a corporate culture of innovation and self-disruption, create products and services that are in high demand, that exhibit strong brand love from customers, are serving a global opportunity, and appeal to multiple demographic groups. What's the reward for a company that meets these criteria? More revenue, more cash flow, higher market share, and the potential to reach the $1 trillion club. Please enjoy our next episode of Mega Brands.
Eric Clark is the portfolio manager for the Rational Dynamic Brands Fund in conjunction with his partners at Acuvest Global Advisors. All opinions expressed by Eric and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Acuvest Global Advisors or Rational Funds. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of the Brands Fund or Acuvest may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Hey, everybody, it's Eric Clark with Mega Brands. It's been a few months, so looking forward to getting back into the podcast conversations. Today's should be really fun with John Rotonti. Before I get into it, today is Tuesday, May 2nd, about 12 p.m. Pacific time. And it's funny, you know, like most of us that are on Twitter, you know, you connect with some really smart, savvy market participants and analysts and portfolio managers. And I would put John into that category. His Twitter handle is at JR Ogro. So J Rogro on Twitter. And just a little bit of background, you know, like many in the industry, John started investing and looking at businesses at a very young age in college. And so he's been, you know, looking at businesses, been a value investor for 25 years, graduated with honors from the University of Richmond, also had an MBA as part of the Beta Gamma Sigma International Honor Society from Tulane, a very fun town of New Orleans. We can talk about Tipitina's, the really fun bar in Tulane. Also, John published a book on investing titled A Manual on Common Stock Investing in 2013. And for the past 9 years, John's been the senior analyst portfolio lead and the head of investor training and development at The Motley Fool. So he recently resigned from The Fool to take on a bigger, more fun adventure as a senior analyst at an institutional value shop. So I'm super pumped to hear where he lands. I know the search is ongoing. So without any further ado, let's talk to John Rotonti about the quality style factor. Lots of different factors underneath that that tend to have pretty good predictive capabilities and some stocks that we both own and or are considering owning in this current environment. Hey, John, how are you?
I'm doing well, Eric. Thanks for having me on the show.
Man, I got so much to talk about. You know, let's start off a little bit on sentiment. I'd love to get your read because, you know, if you go to social media, particularly your Twitter, man, it's just, it seems like more bears have much louder voices always, I think. But right now, it just seems like every tweet is, the banks are going to collapse and this and that. And I haven't seen more things that excite me in brand world than I have in a while. So, you know, either I'm dumb or I'm missing something. Or so just curious to, you know, hear what your thoughts are on sentiment. And then we can get into the screening and, you know, kind of stock talk.
You're definitely not dumb. And I don't think you're missing anything at all. So I agree that sentiment is negative around, you know, several different industries right now. Banking, it was really negative a few months ago on home builders. It's very negative right now around commercial real estate. But that's where I'm most bullish, right? And so I start to get really excited about opportunities when the sentiment around those industries or sectors gets most negative. And so I'm finding incredible, maybe incredible is a stretch. I'm finding very attractive opportunities right now in beaten down sectors. But at a macro level, you know, I'm not very bullish. And so, you know, I'm sort of like neutral to maybe slightly bearish. I don't love those terms, but at the, you know, macro level, but I'm finding a lot of attractive stocks to buy. And so it's this weird place to be, you know, at a macro level, Eric. It's just, I've always said, and I've been very vocal and open about this on Twitter, that I thought it was going to be easier to go from 9% inflation down to 5 or 4% than to go from 4% down to 2%. I was never in the full-on transitory camp. And I was vocal about that as well. I do think some aspects of inflation are transitory, but I think there are enough factors that aren't transitory, in my opinion, to keep inflation stubbornly above the Fed's 2% target. And so, you know, that's one thing. What is the Fed going to do with inflation still well above target? Traditionally, when we're entering a recession, or when the economy looks like it could potentially take a downturn, traditionally the Fed is lowering rates into that environment. But we're still raising rates. So we've got rising interest rates. We've got an inverted yield curve. And then we've had all this banking stress. I think 4 bank failures, if you count Credit Suisse, in the last couple of weeks. And very strong possibility of increased banking regulation. That all leads to less lending and tighter credit. And credit really is the fuel of our economy. And if we siphon too much of that fuel out of the economy, then I do think that we could have some degree of downturn in the, you know, short to medium term, let's say 12 months. I mean, that's just a guess, but within the next year or so.
I mean, listen, the Fed has basically told us that's what they want, right? And they're creating all the collateral damage that allows them to do the work for them. So I suspect the rate hikes are probably, you know, one and done maybe, but because the collateral damage from their rate hikes might allow the markets to get tighter, that gives them what they want without having to do what they were going to do. We'll see. Who knows? I realized that I was a much better investor when I ignored macro. I got all caught up in macro. And I was like, it's a rabbit hole that you could disappear very easily into, because these people aren't bullish ever.
This is true. This
right.
Is
They're
true.
Always looking for the next calamity. And I'm just, you know, always in the dumpster looking for the next diamond.
I agree with that. But like I said, even though I'm expecting some degree of downturn, I am finding good opportunities in those beaten down sectors.
Right. Well, let's talk about that. So we talked on Twitter, and I've, you know, occasionally I'll do the, you know, it's time for, you know, screening fun, where I'm going to put a bunch of style factors in, and I'm going to, you know, put that through the Brands 200 index names, and let's see what, you know, out comes the sausage. Let's see what names come in. And so we did a couple of quality screens. Now for most folks, if you invest in quality companies, I mean, one, there's a lot of common sense to that being a part of your or all of your long-term investment process. But in 2022, those stocks, from a fundamental perspective, largely did really well. I mean, I would say 90% of the companies that we owned in the Brands Fund, they performed just like we thought or better, but the market didn't care. Interest rates up, multiples come down, they sell everything that's growth oriented. And you just saw LVMH, Nike down 40, Starbucks down 40, you know, Amazon over 50 at the lows, Meta down 75%. So this was not the reality of the business. This was just markets in the casino doing what they do. And, you know, on Twitter, I always bark at the illogic of public markets being the the standard that we should all use for the reality of a business's value. That's just ridiculous. You can't tell me Meta was worth $1 trillion and then $250 billion in less than a year, and that was actually true. That's silly. So from the screening perspective, we had a couple that you let's talk about Domino's, because that one, we've owned it in the past. It's, you know, gotten beaten up. So I always, you know, I'm a growth investor that seems to think with a value person's perspective, because I love to buy good stuff that's on sale. So let's talk a little bit about Domino's and some of the things that you like about Domino's.
So, you know, in an environment when we could potentially be going into a recession, I want to own primarily, I think, companies that sell stuff that people actually need, right? Companies serving a crucial need in the economy, rather than, you know, things that people just enjoy having. And food is one of the most essential needs that I can think of. And if you're talking about feeding a family of five, I don't think you can do it much cheaper than Domino's. You know, they have that national deal where you can get a pizza for $6.99. And so if you get three of those, that's $21. If you add tax, you know, maybe you're at $23 and change, $23. That's $4.50 a person for a five-person family, if you're picking up the pizza and you're not having it delivered. I don't know of a more affordable way to feed a family of five. And so it's serving a crucial economic need at a very affordable price point. I think that's the first thing. The second thing is that I've been doing this for 25 years, almost 24 years, Eric, and I'm aware of like five, maybe 10 companies that generate more economic profit, actual EVA, economic value added, than they do GAAP earnings. And Domino's is one of those five. You know, it generates 50 to 60% returns on invested capital, and it year in and year out generates more economic profit than it does GAAP earnings or even adjusted earnings. And so it's one of the highest quality businesses I've ever come across. It's one of the high, you know, generates some of the best business economics I've ever come across. And then thirdly, I would just say that it's trading at close to its lowest multiple of earnings in a decade, going back to 2013. Right now, I don't know if it's at 21 or 22 times, but it almost never gets lower than that. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of like adjusted earnings. If you take actual economic profit, EVA, it's trading at a much lower multiple than that, maybe a high teens multiple. Finally, if I reverse DCF it, I use the new construct reverse DCF, the market is assuming very low expectations for this company. I mean, it's assuming the company only has to grow revenue low single digits for the next 2 or 3 years to justify today's stock price, even though I think management's guiding for 4 to 8%, if I remember correctly, on the revenue line. And so I just think it's attractively valued, serving a crucial economic need, and it generates some of the highest returns and margins I've ever come across.
I mean, to see this stock 44% below the highs, you know, is this thing, you know, did it suffer from inflation and high input costs and a lack of labor, or it was just getting squeezed? I mean, you know, I haven't followed it closely since we sold it. So I'm sitting here looking at the screener, and it screens unbelievably well on operating ROIC. They've reduced their share count. It's in the 94th, you know, percentile of reducing its share count over the last 3 years, you know, 83% on buyback authorization. So they're buying back stock, which is great. You know, 82% on dividend, 3-year dividend growth. So they're clearly generating some free cash flow and paying that in a dividend. I'm sure it's probably small, you know, fairly decent on the shareholder yield. So there's some really interesting metrics, and yet the stock's down 44%. So, you know, that appeals to the growth investor, but it also appeals to the value investor now.
Yeah, I do think it was inflation. I think they faced three sources of inflation. So they had input cost inflation. The cost of food was up dramatically in last year, and they're expecting it'll be up, I think, 3 to 5% again this year. So they're still facing a little food cost inflation, although it's moderating. They suffered from higher gas prices, but those are coming down a bit. And then they did have a driver shortage, a labor shortage, and wages are going up as well. So they suffered from wage price inflation. But, you know, they implemented a couple of price increases last year in 2022. Those have been well accepted. Honestly, if you look relative to the industry, I think they have more room to increase price. I'm not saying they should. I'm just saying some of their competitors have been much more aggressive with price. For example, Chipotle, but there's a litany of competitors that have increased prices more than Domino's have. So it's almost like they have some pent up pricing power if they ever need to exercise it. But you know, this is just, it's a brand that scales globally. They've got, I don't know what it is, 20,000 restaurants in 90 markets around the world. They're vertically integrated because they're also a supply chain provider. So they supply all of the food to the restaurants, and they're a royalty franchise model. And when you add all of that up, the vertical integration, the royalty model, and they're just an exceptional marketing company and advertising company. You know, you've got a company that is, I think, going to be growing for the foreseeable future, mid-single digits, let's say. Add in buybacks and you get earnings per share growth in the high single, low double digits, and, you know, just incredible returns on invested capital. But yeah, you're right. They were fighting inflation. I think the other thing is this is a brand that doesn't, it hasn't marketed well to millennials and Gen Z yet, I don't think, on like TikTok and some of these other platforms. But they're so good at marketing, you know, I think they could figure that out.
Yeah. And I you know, listen, if anybody follows me on Twitter, I tend to post my pizzas and all that stuff. I am the admitted food snob. I don't like Domino's pizza. And so it's kind of in that Yum Brands, you know, kind of faster food perspective. But I see the need. I mean, I love Costco is one of our biggest positions. I hate going to Costco. I mean, but I've had a membership for, you know, well over a decade. Right. So we still go. It's not one of my favorites. So I'm sitting here looking at this thing. It's about as oversold as it tends to get. It's, you know, if you just take a 15-year kind of mean reversion, you know, if you smooth out the stock price, 18%, it's basically got 18% higher to go just to get back to its long-term kind of trend line, which gets me really intrigued as a, you know, as a guy who's, you know, likes to buy diamonds in the dumpster. So that's super interesting. I might just buy some today, put it right in the brands fund.
It's a good one. You know, I think I bought it last at $295. I put it in this portfolio that I was leading at the Motley Fool right around 295. Mm-hmm. And I made it a big position in that portfolio. I don't know if I made it a 4 or 5% position, but, you know, I have really high long-term conviction. If you were to ask me what the market is missing around Domino's, it's that, you know, if you do a quick screen, it for PE ratio, it's at 22, but I don't think that's accurate. I think if you, since it's one of the only five companies I'm aware of that generates economic profit higher than reported earnings, if you're using economic profit, the multiple is lower than that. And so, you know, I think you're getting one of the great brands around the world at, you know, mid-teens multiple, and it's growing.
Got it. Okay. Well, let's move on to some other style factors. You know, right now, let's face it, the world is a little more uncertain. people and investors and traders, you know, they're looking for things that are a little more stable, predictable, companies that can generate consistent cash flows and have stable, predictable earnings, that have good operating efficiencies. Certainly technology, they overhired through the pandemic. We see it in Amazon. We see it in most of those names. Now they're all right-sizing those. What from a high free cash flow yield, high size. This is a screen that I just created, you know, bigger and go up in size, go up with some dividends and shareholder yield, more low vol, low debt to EV, strong interest coverage to pay off whatever debt you have, predictable earnings, and with a little bit of estimate revisions on the positive side. O'Reilly comes up constantly, and we've gone back and forth on Twitter. I've just missed it. Every time I try to go buy it, it just looks like it's ahead of itself and it's a trading expensive. And yet they just keep taking market share from, yeah, you know, Genuine Parts and Advanced Auto Parts and whoever. So, I mean, you put it on my radar screen maybe a year ago when you showed a chart that showed how much they have been buying back their own stock and reducing the share count over the last 15 years. I mean, this is one of those names that, you know, most people won't own, and yet they've missed a massive ride, myself included.
O'Reilly, yeah. Just, you know, once again, this theme of buying, investing in businesses that serve a crucial economic need, things that people need in their lives, people or businesses need in their lives, and we need auto parts. We may not need to buy a car right now. You know, that's debatable, because I do think there's a need for new cars. But what we do definitely need is to have our cars fixed and repaired and maintained. So once again, serves a crucial economic need. As like you said, as far as predictable earnings, this is a company that's grown comp sales, you know, since maybe forever. It increases its profits, you know, year in and year out. It generates almost obscene returns on invested capital. It doesn't pay a dividend, but it consistently buys back a lot of stock. And, you know, on the consumer front, I think it's about 50-50 consumer pro. I'd have to double check, but, you know, consumers need advice and guidance. If I don't know how to fix a car myself. And so I need that advice and guidance. 90%, Eric, here's a stat, 90% of, it's about 90, consumers that search for an auto part on O'Reilly.com end up going to buy it in the store anyway, because they go to O'Reilly.com and then they realize, you know what, I'm just not sure if this is the right part, or I'm just not sure how to install it properly. So they start their search on O'Reilly.com, but then 90% of them end up going to the store anyway. And then on the pro side, pros need their parts within an hour or less to keep those service bays moving. We're not talking about same day or next day delivery. We're talking about hour delivery. And that's what O'Reilly's supply chain and distribution footprint allows the company to do. It has a massive moat, and you know the market knows it now. You know, I think it's close to its all time high, and it trades at, you know, a pretty high multiple of earnings and free cash flow. I don't know if it's 20 or 25 times, but the market is now aware of how good of a capital allocator O'Reilly is, and how the duration of the growth story. The market is aware that it's a long-term growth story.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, now you're, like you said, it's not cheap.
No,
you know, but when they're taking market share, and you know, this is a important economic need for people, that feeds into the stable, predictable earnings. And we already know management team manages the business incredibly well. So, you know, absolutely, if you're going to take a risk on higher valuation, do it in an industry that's doing really well with a brand that has a big moat and that operates the business incredibly well. That helps, you know, mitigate some of the valuation issues that you might have in your mind. Most of the time, it's in your mind.
Absolutely. And, you know, so PE ratios are not just these made up numbers, as you know, they're driven by math, and PE ratios are driven by three inputs, specifically return on invested capital, especially return on incremental invested capital, NOPAT growth, so basically growth of operating income after tax, and then the cost of capital or risk, and risk flows through the PE ratio in terms of the cost of capital. And so it's got extremely high returns on invested capital, so it gets a check there. It's got consistent, as you said, predictable NOPAT growth, and so it gets a check there. The formula actually rewards long duration predictable growth as much as it does sort of high growth that could flame out, right? And then that flows in through risk. So it's a low risk company because, like you said, it serves a need and it's got predictable earnings growth. And so it gets a check on all three of the inputs that would justify or warrant a high PE. And so that's why it has a high PE of 24 times, because it's justified.
Right. You know, I'll put the blog note out, and I think I've hinted with a couple of these charts over the last couple of days, but just so people understand the power of investing in brands that serve the consumer, I just went out and I created a hindsight portfolio. Like if you sat down today and we're going to create the you know, a 40 or 45 stock portfolio, equal weighted, of brands that you think are the most relevant in the most important spending categories, and you looked backwards, and I cut out the ones that didn't have long track records, and there were some good ones. It was a crazy analysis going back to 2002, right after the Netflix IPO. This 45 stock portfolio that included O'Reilly and didn't include Domino's, because I think Domino's came public much later than 02, 19.5% annualized versus 9%. Right.
Wow.
And my view is, it's absurd. And My view is like, don't care, you know, I'll get blamed for cherry picking and all that garbage, but it's simply meant to say, it's not illogical for, you know, a consumer economy to have a bunch of great companies that are most relevant in consumers' minds to be great companies and then ultimately be great stocks. That, I don't know that anybody would dispute that thesis.
It's a strong thesis.
I just wanted to prove that thesis by showing this hindsight portfolio. So
it's I'm glad you created that portfolio and did that back test. You know, the consumer is 70% of the U.S. economy.
And it's 60% of world economy. So
and 60% of the world economy. It's exactly right. And so, you know, a lot of people get excited by enterprise software and all this stuff. And, you know, I'm sure there are some good enterprise software companies. But the opportunity, the addressable market, the TAM on the consumer side is just so much larger, so much larger. And if you look at the largest companies in the world, nearly all of them have a massive consumer brand. Google, Microsoft, Apple, Tesla. These are massive consumer brands first and foremost. First and foremost. Yes, some of them serve the enterprise, but they're consumers first and foremost. And so, yeah, if you want to really go after big TAMs, Amazon. I can't believe I forgot to mention Amazon. You know, that's where it is on the consumer side.
And I use that this mega brands term, and to me, it's, you know, if you even want the possibility of joining this $1 trillion club, having a $1 trillion market cap, you have to serve this global audience and have, you know, be able to serve kids all the way up to older people. You know, the bigger the TAM, the bigger the opportunity to be part of that $1 trillion club. There have been a few that we're joining. Maybe NVIDIA is the next one. I mean, there's certainly a lot of hype around AI, and I've spent some time on ChatGPT, and it's freaky and amazing. So maybe the hype drives NVIDIA to be the next $1 trillion company, we'll see. But it's not surprising if you are that brand and you have the right to sell us even more products over time, like an Apple, and you serve the global consumer and you have good profitability, man, great things can happen as a stock. And so you're always looking for the next. Who has all of those things able to drive them to the next trillion? Because obviously, Apple's what, almost 3 trillion if it's not already. So let's jump right in. Before we're going to get to the private, the Blackstones and the KKRs of the world. But let's get into, and I'll let you dealer's choice if you want to talk about CarMax or you want to talk about NextEra or a Lowe's, whatever you want to talk about. And then we'll pause for a second while I switch over and then we'll keep running and get to the privates.
Let me say 30 seconds on NVIDIA. Sure. NVIDIA I own NVIDIA as well. It may end up being the next trillion-dollar company. And if that's the case, it'll really be probably the first one that didn't start off primarily as a consumer brand. However, it is a strong consumer brand on the gaming side. The top gamers in the world use NVIDIA graphics cards. And then they've got their GeForce, I think it's called. So even NVIDIA has a fairly large consumer brand, not as large as the other ones we mentioned, but so that one would probably break the mold. But right after that, you've got Facebook could become a trillion, and then you've got Visa at about 500 billion. Massive consumer brand, right? And so I think the thesis still holds. I'll touch on CarMax briefly. Let's see. So CarMax hit a low of $44, Eric, in March of 2020. So during the height of the pandemic was raging. CarMax was forced to close, I think, all of its stores, and it furloughed thousands of workers. I think new shelter-in-place orders and a lockdown of the economy is an extremely low probability event. And so I think 44 is probably a floor on the stock. I think CarMax is at $70 a share today, which is just massively off its all-time high of 155. So at $70, I think CarMax is trading at about 11 or 12, let's say 12 times mid-cycle normalized earnings. I think mid-cycle normalized earnings for CarMax is about $6 per share. And so at 70, it's about 12 times that. So 12 times for a company that once again serves a crucial economic need, buying and selling affordable cars. It has a strong enough balance sheet to withstand pretty much any crisis. I mean, this is a company that survived the dot-com. It survived global financial crisis, and it survived COVID. And it came out the other side of all three of those crises with more market share, right? So it serves a crucial economic need, has a strong enough balance sheet. Its 10-year average return on invested capital is 15%. 10-year average return on equity is 20%. And its 5-year historical earnings per share CAGR is 15%, right? So for not a great, but a very good business, historically has grown earnings per share 15%. You're paying 12 times normalized earnings. Now, its 5- and 10-year average forward PE is 17. It's currently trading at 12. If you apply a 17 times multiple to $6 in normalized earnings, which is my estimate, you get $100 stock, over $100 stock, really. And so, you've got an upside downside ratio of 2. So that's a pretty good, I think that's a pretty good opportunity in today's market. Really quickly on the utilities, if you're talking about predictable growth, it doesn't get more predictable than utilities because they have regulated growth. And there's this electrification of everything. So utilities are interesting. A lot of people don't understand the accounting of utilities. They think that they're generating negative cash flow or all these things, but utilities actually get to pass through a lot of their costs. They pass through fuel. They pass through the interest on their debt. And so they're actually, you know, they're good earners. They generate good economic profits. And if you look at a company like, I mean, NextEra is the largest renewable company in the world. They're vertically integrated. They do it all. It's traded off some. So I do think that one's attractive. But if you look at PG&E, the formerly bankrupt utility out of California, you know, it came out of bankruptcy. This thing has new management, exceptional management. It's growing faster than all the other utilities, but it's trading at a much discounted multiple. So, you know, just those are the things I'm looking at. You know, one last thing, PG&E, it charges one in every six EVs in the country just because it's in California. Yeah.
Right.
It's responsible for charging one in six EVs in the country.
Hey, I'm doing my part.
I know you are.
Driving up electricity prices.
Yeah, there you go, man.
Okay, hold on 1 second. Okay, let's get into the ugly stepchild asset class of private markets. You know, what used to be such a great business and such a wonderful thematic has seemed to turn into bashing. And I always use that Reggie Jackson phrase, nobody boos a loser. The public markets, I mean, I see it with Cliff Asness, who I respect an awful lot. He's constantly bashing privates and the marks that they take or the lack thereof. So let's get into privates, because long term, we know this industry is growing like crazy. I see it daily. High net worth individuals just getting a piece of their portfolios managed through Blackstone or KKR, Apollo, or, you know, lots of those different providers. That's like inning number one, and we're not even done inning number one. But there is a bit of a pause, you know, in these businesses. This isn't a great time to buy a business. The cost of capital is much higher. But these guys always find a way to win. And typically, they're the last man standing in distress when everybody's under their desk. Blackstone, KKR, Apollo, those guys are out buying assets on the cheap. So would love to hear your opinion. You know, we've talked a little bit about them, but let's talk about the marks and the business overall and what maybe people are missing. Because, you know, just an FYI on Blackstone in particular, you know, just to get back to the dividend that we had, I think it was February of last year, you're talking about a 68% increase in the dividend over time. We know they're going to get there. It's just a matter of time. So you have this embedded dividend growth that you're going to get, but you still have a 3.5% dividend yield strictly on Blackstone while you wait for that industry to kind of get its footing a little bit. And I certainly don't see distress in the eyes of John Gray or Schwartzman or Mark Rowan at Apollo, who I really, really respect. So we'd love to, let's talk about privates and your views there.
I'm very uncomfortable buying what everyone else is buying. And I'm just naturally that way. And I'm very comfortable buying what everyone else is bashing. You know, I was very vocal about how bullish I was on home builders when everyone was bashing them. They traded down to 4x earnings and they traded at a discount to the liquidation value of the land on their balance sheets. That excited me because everyone else was bashing them. Right now, everyone on Twitter is saying, never invest in banks, never invest in banks. And, you know, that may turn out to be right, but I can't help myself, Eric. And so right now I'm buying banks because that's where the distress is. I'm trying to figure out, I'm going to get to Blackstone and KKR in a second. I'm trying to figure out the best way to invest in commercial real estate other than through the privates and the alts. Because that's what's getting crushed right now. And so I want to go to where all the bashing is happening. Regarding the alternative asset managers, you know, at a high level, these are extremely diversified business models. Private equity, in a lot of cases, is not even their largest, you know, revenue driver anymore. So they're extremely diversified. They invest across the growth spectrum and pay good dividends, buy back stock, exceptionally well managed, and they've traded off. And so they're attractively priced, in my opinion. I do think there is a lot that is misunderstood. So, for example, there's this idea that higher rates are across the board bad for alternative asset managers because higher rates will make it harder to raise additional capital. Well, we saw that wasn't true because Blackstone just raised its largest real estate fund ever. I don't remember how much it was, 20 or 30 billion, but it was some like egregiously obscene high number, and they did it without breaking a sweat. So what's more important than the rates, in my opinion, is the brand and the returns they have provided investors over time. But then there's this idea that, you know, interest rates will make it more difficult to do leverage buyouts. Yes, higher rates do make debt financing more expensive to do LBOs. But believe it or not, interest rates are not the primary driver of returns. Just like, you know, you don't want your cost of capital to be the primary driver of your DCF. You know, ideally, you'd like to find a business where the value, the intrinsic value growth is coming from revenue growth and margin expansion. It's the same with the alts. Really, where the most value is coming from is by being an expert in improving the operations, margins, and cash flows of the businesses they are buying when they are doing these LBOs. If they are good at improving the operations, the margins, and the cash flows, that's going to create much more value than the higher interest rates are going to decrease from the value. So there's more positives than there are negatives there, in my opinion. And then finally, their credit business, which, as you know, I know we're both extremely bullish on the opportunities that are going to come down the pipe in credit. Their credit business is 90% floating rate debt. I'm talking about Blackstone here, but you know, it's very similar at KKR. I'm less familiar with Apollo, although I do know Rowan is a genius. 90% floating rate debt. And so investors in its credit funds actually make more money when rates go up. And then finally, Blackstone's balance sheet benefits a little bit by earning more on its treasury portfolio, right? So it gets more interest income on its massive balance sheet. So it's not as simple as saying higher rates are going to crush the alternative asset business model, because these aren't just LBO buyers anymore. They're alternatives, they're diversified, there's puts and takes, and some of its lines of business actually benefit from higher rates.
Fun fact, because of all of this fear, uncertainty, and doubt out there, I went back and looked at Blackstone in particular, because they have the longest public history. And I looked at their 2007 annual report from 11/1 of 87 to the end of 2007. Average Fed funds were 4.8%, kind of where we are now.
Yep.
It was much higher, it was a little bit lower. Average CPI about 3 and change. Over that period of time, Blackstone's corporate private equity annualized net of all fees, 22%, S&P up 11%. Over that same period, their core, their real estate franchise annualized 29% versus the S&P. This is going back to since inception in 1992 at 10%. So in other periods when Fed funds were where they are now, they did just fine. These guys always figure, they find a way to win because they're the people looking around for where the distress is, and they have big checkbooks and they have a lot of patience.
Yeah.
Right. You just have, listen, they trade like 2X, 3X levered equities for obvious reasons. So you just, you know, when you own these businesses, you just have to be willing to absorb a little of the volatility of the stock and separate that from the business opportunities that they seem to always have. And like you said, they've raised a massive amount of money over the last 2 years. Like Blackstone alone has raised $400 billion or more in fresh capital. There's almost $200 billion of that as dry powder now. So they're very patient. And I love that about them, you know, so they don't care about catching the bottom.
Yeah, I just agree with everything that you just said. And then, you know, you mentioned the marks, right? And so it's just this amazing conundrum that I can't wrap my head around. Everyone claims to be a long-term investor, But then they think that public marks, which move daily, Eric, is the right way to value a long-term holding. Right. And so you've got, it's just, I'm not saying that some of these private marks don't have to come down a bit more. I don't have that level of detail, right? I haven't gone into the black box that much, but I also don't think public marks, once again, with daily volatility, is the way to value a long-term stream of cash flows that you can own for 5, 7, 10 years. That's the first thing. The other thing is, Blackstone, KKR, you name it, they are using DCFs to value their private companies. They do those DCFs quarterly for their drawdown funds, okay? They do those quarterly. And they've been doing it like that. Oh, and then those valuations have to be approved by a third-party auditor quarterly. And they've been doing it that way for 40 years, right? And so maybe the marks have to come down a bit, but I just don't think it's this existential crisis that we're hearing about in the financial media. Maybe I'm wrong. I've been wrong before, and I'm going to be wrong again. But, you know, I'm very bullish on KKR and Blackstone here. I think that both are roughly a double from here. That's my personal opinion.
I couldn't disagree with any of that. You know, I do find it interesting. If you ask someone what drives the daily prices in the public markets, it's sentiment, right?
Yes.
And so if we know that it's sentiment, then how can you then say privates should be valued on the same thing that publics are, which is sentiment? And we know that that's not real, right? What you want to pay for something today is based on so many different things. Algorithms drive 80% of the daily flows at this point. So it's computers just trading short-term momentum signals. So yes, these firms raised a ton of money the last 3 years. So yes, they have purchased some assets at peak prices and peak valuations. It would be no different than you saying, you know, I bought Domino's at the top of the market, and then it's down 40%, let's say. But mm-hmm. You also acquired a bunch of things that you bolted onto Domino's to help them grow faster, and you spent more money on buying that company lower, making your average cost much more attractive than the one top tick that you had. And I always use that, you know, and Blackstone obviously does too, their purchase of Hilton literally at the peak of the market in 2007. Clearly, yeah. In hindsight, it was a terrible timing. They made a gazillion dollars. It didn't matter. So, you know.
Yeah, people call it one of the best real estate deals of all time.
Yeah. And you know, we can bash P. Reed. I frankly don't understand why, you know, if you're a holder of B. Reed, the Blackstone's commercial real estate fund that's available to the high net worth group, you've gotten nothing but great income, stable returns, and well above average returns when compared to the public markets. So aside from the fear and the uncertainty and doubt that the media is spreading literally every minute of every day about commercial real estate and the office sector in particular, which is less than 2% of their book, and it's already been written down.
Yeah.
It literally makes no sense. Why? I don't even know who these people are and why they're leaving. Where are you going to go? By the time you finally get your money out from all the gating, you're going to wish you were back in anyway. It's absolutely taking that long. So it's just a narrative that people love to push on.
A lot of them are being margin called. And so it's not that they want to leave. It's just that they have to leave. A lot of those big asset allocators, big investors, high net worth individuals are being margin called. That was one thing. But yeah, you know, just really quickly on the marks again, This narrative has been around for 30 or 40 years. And not only are they doing DCF valuations quarterly, it's not only DCF, they're also using comparative multiples, so market comps. But then they add a liquidity discount to that. And so, you know, I got to think these things are not massively overvalued on their books. Think about, so like, let's, you know, they don't, I don't see the long-term benefit they get from not adequately marking down something, because eventually the truth's going to come out, right?
Exactly.
Because then they monetize it. And if they monetize it well below the marks, right? If they monetize it well below what they carried it on their books, the LPs are going to be pissed. The LPs are then going to start questioning all the other marks. These companies do not want to upset their LPs. So I just don't think that they're massively out of line. I'm not saying some of them need to be tweaked. I'm not saying some of them don't need to be lowered. I don't have access to that data, or at least I have not gone that deep. I just don't think they're massively out of line.
So here's a real world example. I have a good friend, used to work with, you know, runs $16 billion of endowment assets. You know, roughly 50% of the portfolio is privates across all kinds of things: venture, private equity, infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. Handily outperformed his benchmark, doing really well for all the clients. And he said something which I wish high net worth individuals would really consider, or their advisors would consider. One, it's a smoother ride, and you can talk about whether there's some sort of like haze that's creating this smoother ride, or that it's not real. The reality is you're talking about four decades worth of a smoother ride with better returns, particularly when you're good at picking the firms and the funds. And so I agree with you. You know, what's in it for Blackstone or KKR or Apollo or whoever to risk their entire business and their brand, right? These guys are generally, I can't speak to the middle market guy. I'm sure there are a lot of, just like every industry, there's a lot of businesses that are really shady, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the best of the best, where the smartest, most well-researched investors put their money. And so you have to trust and rely on this industry and the way that they do things and their expertise and that unbelievable information advantage. When you're Blackstone and you own 264 companies and you employ 700,000 employees and you aggregate all the data from your businesses to give you a really good real-time kind of viewpoint of what the economy is doing and where the pockets of trouble and or exuberance could be, and then be able to use that information to act on future positioning, I mean, that is an unbelievable legal advantage over what you get in public markets, because companies, they don't want to tell you anything because they're always worried about lawsuits.
You just described a massive brain trust, a massive, you know, just intelligence depot that could rival ChatGPT. You're right. I mean, they have this brain trust globally that allows them to act very quickly, very intelligently in distress situations. I can't think of a firm, you know, maybe other than Berkshire Hathaway, honestly, that has more capital available to invest countercyclically in distress assets in a downturn than the three major alternative asset managers: Blackstone, KKR, and Apollo. I just can't think of another one. You know, Berkshire's up there, but other than that, that's who's left.
And you know, I'm a big believer. You know, some people love their everything in their portfolio to work at all the time, but that implies that you are clustered into probably one very small sliver of style factors, and style factor performance changes over time. So I kind of like to have part of my hopefully, let's call it 2/3 of my portfolio is working. it's certainly working this year, didn't work last year, and we're seeing the snapback year to date so far. But I also have a third of my portfolio that isn't working right now that will pay dividends later when maybe some of the other stuff cools off. And that's kind of the way I look at these privates. And we own, full disclosure, we own Blackstone, we own KKR, and we own Apollo. I recently sold the, I had a trading gain in Brookfield. I just wanted to be able to cluster my concentration in the firms that I know the best and that I believe mm-hmm. in the best. And mm-hmm. I'm sure the guys from Brookfield are really good too, but that's a business that's a lot more complex versus the top three. And in this market, particularly in the ultra high net worth, that adoption of privates, the most amount of market share goes to the largest group. It just, where if you have a big brand, you're going to opt for the big guys versus some private equity firm or private credit shop that you may or may not know. So I think they're going to get a disproportionate amount of the assets and therefore revenues just in that channel alone. I just want to end. I know you got to hop here. J&J is doing a spinoff of their consumer brand division. It's called Kenview. I hope to God they didn't spend any time or money on that name. maybe hopefully over time it'll wear on me a little bit more positively, but to me it just doesn't really resonate. But the amount of brands, literally, I went around my house, and I if you have any information on Kenview or what your thoughts are from a timeliness of this IPO, I mean, just in my house alone, I have Band-Aids, Johnson's baby shampoo, mostly for my dog now because my daughter's 12, Listerine, Aveeno, Neutrogena, Lubriderm, Neosporin, Tylenol, Motrin, Benadryl, OGX, that's a shampoo.
Yep.
Sudafed, Pepcid, Zyrtec. Hopefully I don't need any Rogaine. You and I look pretty good on the Rogaine part.
So far, so good.
But oh my God.
I don't know if you mentioned Listerine.
Listerine too.
I don't know if you mentioned, Aveeno, like moisturizer, Tylenol, Zyrtec, Motrin. It goes on and on. I haven't looked at the numbers of this spinoff, if they've even been released yet. But once again, it is massive consumer brands that people trust and covet. It's, predictable, slow growth, but predictable. And it's stuff that people need. And it's in a lot of ways recurring, right? Because you use your Listerine, you got to go buy another one, right? You run out of this stuff, and so you just go buy more. I don't, for me, it would come down to how much debt are they going to put on this thing, and what's the valuation, basically. But it's something I will definitely take a look at.
I suspect it's going to be a fairly popular deal, given, people's caution about the economy. So from a timeliness perspective, it's probably the absolute perfect time to be releasing this company into the new stock. They say it's going to have, somewhere around $2 billion of free cash flow, a 3.7% dividend, about $14 billion in revenue. But, you do have some of this overhang of this talc litigation, even though J&J has agreed to kind of shield them from I think it's like $9 billion of potential litigation. So, there is going to be maybe a little bit of a discount, but versus one of the other recent spinouts, I can't remember the name of this thing, but I just think it's going to be a pretty hot deal. And then the quality of these brands at this time is pretty interesting. So I'm hopeful that it doesn't come off super hot and just, kind of erase that valuation discount that it looks like it might have, but we'll see. I suspect it'll be pretty hot.
Yeah, you mentioned a good point. I didn't know that the talc was being put onto Kenview, so I'm going to have to look at that too. But you said $2 billion in free cash flow and $14 billion of revenue. I mean, that's not a bad free cash flow margin.
Yep.
J&J has run into quality issues with some of its products over, definitely talc is the worst, but they had a medical device tool, as a morselator that I think was speculated, I don't know if it was proven, caused cervical cancer in certain women. Tylenol way back in the day had cyanide in it. You know, they've had occasional over time quality control problems and other sort of ESG issues. So like you said, it may trade at some sort of discount given this talcum powder. I didn't know that was going to be put on the new company, but something to definitely look at.
Yeah, no, it's very, they really haven't put that much information out. I mean, they haven't even put out that I can find the ratio. You know, if you're a J&J shareholder, you get X number of shares.
Right, right.
They haven't put anything out yet.
Okay.
And the IPO is supposed to happen sometime on Thursday. So stay tuned for that. When the symbol will be KVUE, I believe, for Kenvue. And again, I just hope they didn't spend millions and millions of dollars on that brand name.
You're right. You know, just really quickly, I know I got to go, but we didn't plan this, but you know, the market was down today. CarMax was up. Domino's was up. Let me just check O'Reilly really quick, because this would be fun and interesting. And O'Reilly was up. Completely unplanned. But like you said, it's nice to have that balance in your portfolio. I think you said 2/3 of your portfolio is working right now. 1/3 isn't. You know, I've owned Berkshire forever. It was sort of a market lagger forever. And then last year, it boosted my portfolio. You know, I beat the market pretty significantly last year because I had very large positions in Berkshire, O'Reilly, and Home Depot. And then I had 30% cash. And so, you know, the cash was a drag forever, but it really helped me last year, right?
Absolutely.
And, you know, Home Depot, O'Reilly, Berkshire, sort of boring names, really propped up my portfolio last year. And so that's a really good point. You want to invest across the spectrum. Not everything is going to work all the time.
Well, you're hired. You're now working on the brands fund, because I should have had a metric ton of cash last year. I generally like Q4 of 18 is a good example. We started to think, okay, the Fed is just hell bent on, you know, tightening the screws right into a slowdown. We started to raise cash in the fourth quarter by, I don't know, the first week in November or so. We had 35% in cash. We sold a bunch of the defensives. We added, you know, things like Verizon and McDonald's and Procter & Gamble, those kind of names. And so, you know, I think in December, the market was down 10 or 11. We were down 5 or so. So I have a prospectus that's very flexible. But man, in 2022, I anchored to the companies and the business. And I was like, LVMH is crushing it.
Nike is, and they still are.
Yeah. Hulu's crushing it. Visa, MasterCard are coming out of really difficult periods because of COVID, and cross-border travel is going to really pick up, which it has. And so, you know, sometimes the market just doesn't care and you got to just get out of the way. And that was my bad, you know, primarily because, you know, like you said, people love to get excited about things when they look the best, but that's not the best prices that you get when that happens. You know, I'm programmed to buy when good things look terrible. And unfortunately in our industry, you know, with advisors and individuals, they love to buy you when you look the best. And then they think you're broken when great businesses are raging table pounding buys. I couldn't get anybody to buy the fund in October last year. And I created charts to show how these brands did when they turn in a negative year. I mean, the evidence couldn't be more compelling, and yet crickets. And now, you know, 22% off the high or wherever we are now. Now people want to go check out the brands fund. And so I'm like, oh, geez, I need
good
to get more defensive.
Yeah.
But now I need to get more defensive and hold more cash.
Exactly. No, I know. They don't make it easy on us. But I don't know. Like you, I want to buy, you know, I tweeted Bill Smead had a quote that they buy when everyone else is messing their pants. But yeah, that's, you know, that's what I want to buy. So right now I am, you know, extremely bullish on oil and gas, excuse me, still bullish on home builders. I've been buying banks hand over fist, And I'm doing a lot of work trying to figure out the best way to play the crash in commercial real estate other than the alts, because I'm already heavily exposed to the alts. At JRoeGrow on Twitter.
So looking forward to following along, and I'll put this out, you know, in the next hour or so for people to consume. So it was good talking to you. Thanks for your time.
Awesome. Talk to you soon.
All right, bud. See ya.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Mega Brands, everybody. I'm your host, Derek Clark. For more information on this podcast and to learn more about the brand relevancy scoring system we use, be sure to check out the website at globalbrandsmatter.com. While you're there, make sure to sign up for the market newsletter and check out my latest thoughts on our favorite portfolio brands in the Dynamic Brands section. If you have any questions or want to learn more about the Dynamic Brands approach, send me a message on the contact tab. Thanks again for listening, everybody. Have a great day.